Such honesty was refreshing, as was his promise to restore the United States' moral standing in the world and learn from Vietnam. He declared that never again should our country become militarily involved in the internal affairs of another nation unless there is a direct and obvious threat to the security of the United States or its people. He vowed never to repeat the false statements and sometimes outright lies that his predecessors had used to justify the U.S. invasion of Vietnam. He raised the hopes of mankind by announcing that the United States would help shape a just and peaceful world that is truly humane. We pledge to limit the world's armaments, and we will move this year a step toward the ultimate goal, the elimination of all nuclear weapons from this earth. We urge all other people to join us, for success can mean life instead of death. Just how heartfelt Carter's comments on Vietnam were is difficult to ascertain. They clearly represented a welcome departure from the apologetics of his predecessors and successors, but they may have represented a kind of dissembling intended to make the new president seem much more liberal than he actually was, or than his record as president would suggest. While campaigning in 1976, Carter responded to a reporter's question about Vietnam by asserting, "I called for a complete pullout," in March 1971, after having previously taken a more typical Southern pro-war position. However, in August of that year, he had written a column saying that he had supported the initial U.S. involvement in Vietnam to fight communist aggression, but now, since we are not going to do what it takes to win, it is time to come home. The following year, he had supported Nixon's bombing of North Vietnam and mining of harbors, and urged Americans to give President Nixon our backing and support, whether or not we agree with that decision. Even as late as April 1975, with Saigon about to fall to the communists and their supporters, he had told reporters that he supported giving the Saigon regime $500 million to $600 million in military aid for another year to help stabilize it. Thus, Carter may never have been as liberal on foreign policy as many assumed he was, but he did manage to rile the CPD crowd by selecting dovish Paul Warnke to head the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. Appointing liberal former Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young, an African-American, as U.N. ambassador, and siding, at least initially, with Vance's lawyerly pragmatism and commitment to détente over the toxic anti-communism of Brzezinski. That allowed Carter to score some significant early successes. He successfully renegotiated the Panama Canal Treaty. In 1978, he helped secure the Camp David Accords, which led to Israeli withdrawal from Egyptian territory, captured in the 1967 war, and the establishment of diplomatic relations between the two countries. He also made headway in arms control. Warnke negotiated the SALT II Treaty with the Soviets, mandating a reduction in nuclear missiles and bombers, and helped convince Carter to resist the Pentagon's pressure to build the B-1 bomber. SALT II, for all the fanfare surrounding its signing in June 1979, was only a measured success, actually allowing both sides to continue their build-ups at a reduced rate. Both parties were permitted to add another 4,000 warheads by 1985 and deploy one new weapon system over the 5-year life of the treaty. C.P. Deers denounced the treaty, claiming that it would give the Soviets strategic superiority and open a window of vulnerability. They called for massive growth in defense spending and civil defense. With the Scaife Foundation pouring over $300,000 into the CPD, foes of SALT II outspent treaty backers by 15 to 1. But Carter's lack of foreign policy experience would come back to haunt him, and his growing reliance on Brzezinski and other hawkish advisors would doom his progressive agenda, leaving the administration's foreign policy awash in a sea of Cold War orthodoxy. Brzezinski quickly instituted a significant change in procedure that allowed him to exert inordinate influence on the president. Whereas in the past, a top CIA official had given the president's daily brief, Brzezinski arranged to do this himself, with no one else present. From the very first day of the presidency, he wrote, I insisted that the morning intelligence briefing be given to the president by me and by no one else. The CIA tried to have me take a briefing officer with me, but I felt that this would inhibit candid talk. Brzezinski overruled Turner's objections. In his memoirs, Brzezinski outlined the deliberate, systematic process whereby he came to shape Carter's thinking on foreign policy issues. In effect, the morning briefing involved a touching of bases, some prodding of the president to think about problems that, in my judgment, needed attention, the planting of basic ideas, and, especially in the first months of his presidency, some wider discussions of conceptual or strategic issues. This was particularly important in the initial stages, when we were defining our broad goals and setting our priorities. I also used the sessions occasionally to make suggestions to Carter as to what he ought to stress in his public statements, including possible formulations or wordings. He was extremely good at picking up phrases, and I was often amazed how after such a morning briefing, he would use in a later press conference or public appearance words almost identical to those we had discussed. Priding himself on being Carter's ventriloquist, Brzezinski outlined the additional steps he had taken to make sure that his lessons sank in. In addition to repeated daily conversations, he began sending Carter a weekly NSC report, which was meant to be a highly personal and private document for the president alone. It usually opened with a one-page editorial from Brzezinski in which he commented in a freewheeling fashion on the administration's performance, alerted him to possible problems, conveyed occasionally some criticism, and attempted to impart a global perspective. Brzezinski noted that Carter sometimes disagreed with his analysis and was irritated by his reports, but the record of the administration shows that Brzezinski's obsessive anti-communism, he bragged about being the first Pole in 300 years in a position to really stick it to the Russians, eventually wore Carter down and won him to Brzezinski's point of view. Carter came to office committed to promoting human rights, but he used human rights as a vehicle for attacking the Soviet Union, causing relations between the two countries to chill. The Soviets, proud of the fact that they had expanded civil liberties and decreased the number of political prisoners in recent years, countered that Soviet citizens had rights that Americans didn't enjoy. The Kremlin instructed Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin to ask Vance how the Americans would feel if the Soviets tied détente to ending U.S. racial discrimination or unemployment. Carter also overreacted to the USSR's support of Mengistu Haile Mariam in Ethiopia. Mengistu had come to power in a 1974 coup that had overthrown Emperor Haile Selassie. During those years, the Soviet Union was taking advantage of the turbulence throughout Africa and the rest of the Third World to align with progressive forces and push socialist models of development. But Third World involvements would repeatedly trap the Soviets in their own quagmires, economically, politically, and militarily. Ethiopia proved to be such a case. In late 1977, Soviet leaders, encouraged by Castro and his support for African liberation movements, responded to requests from Mengistu, who was facing invasion from neighboring Somalia and opposition from a Somali-supported Eritrean independence movement. Despite their criticism of Mengistu's often brutal behavior, the Soviets significantly increased support for Ethiopia's revolutionary government, providing over $1 billion worth of military equipment and 1,000 military advisors. They also assisted in transporting 17,000 Cuban military and technical personnel to assist the Ethiopians. Most African nations applauded the Soviet intervention, viewing it as a legitimate response to Somali aggression. Carter responded mildly at first, sharing Soviet leaders' sense that détente and arms control were the top priorities. Brzezinski, however, urged the president to stop being soft and stand up to the Soviets. A president must not only be loved and respected, he must also be feared, the National Security Advisor argued. He urged Carter to pick some controversial subject on which you will deliberately choose to act with a degree of anger, even roughness, designed to have a shock effect. Carter thought Ethiopia a good place to start. Despite Vance's strong objections, Carter accused the Soviets of expanding their influence abroad through military power and military assistance. Brzezinski was thrilled by Carter's denunciation of Soviet actions. He would later remark on several occasions that salt lies buried in the sands of the Ogaden. The right was more strident in its attack on Soviet adventurism in Africa. Reagan warned, "If the Soviets are successful, and it looks more and more as if they will be, then the entire Horn of Africa will be under their influence, if not their control. From there, they can threaten the sea lanes carrying oil to Western Europe and the United States, if and when they choose. More immediately, control of the Horn of Africa would give Moscow the ability to destabilize those governments on the Arabian Peninsula, which have proven themselves strongly anti-communist. In a few years, we may be faced with the prospect of a Soviet empire of protégés and dependencies stretching from Addis Ababa to Cape Town." Soviet leaders did not anticipate such a strong response in light of similar U.S. actions in its sphere of influence. But they did overestimate U.S. willingness to accord them equal status. Many within the Soviet hierarchy and intelligentsia were already questioning the wisdom of Soviet involvement in countries such as Afghanistan, Angola, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Somalia, and South Yemen, given the repeated unwillingness of their repressive leaders to heed Soviet advice on political and economic issues. Carter's support for human rights prompted Soviet countercharges. In July 1978, Carter deplored and condemned Soviet sentencing of dissident Anatoly Sharansky to 13 years in prison for allegedly spying for the CIA. Carter's charges particularly galled the Soviet leaders because he and Brzezinski had been cozying up to China, whose human rights record was far, far worse. Brzezinski admitted to Carter that China was executing as many as 20,000 prisoners a year. However, the sting of Carter's accusation was blunted by UN Ambassador Andrew Young's telling a French newspaper that there were hundreds, maybe even thousands of people I would call political prisoners in U.S. jails. Criticizing Soviet human rights lapses while supporting other egregious human rights offenders was a dangerous game to play, and sometimes backfired. In 1967, Great Britain announced plans to withdraw its forces from east of Suez. The United States decided to fill the void. It built a military base on the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, from which the British had expelled almost 2,000 natives between 1968 and 1973. The United States would use the base as a launch pad to protect its interests in the Persian Gulf. It also tied its fortunes even more closely to the Shah of Iran, who, along with Israel, became the principal defender of U.S. economic and geopolitical interests in the Persian Gulf, which held 60% of the world's known oil reserves. During these years, the oil-rich Gulf states had begun to play an important role in world economic affairs, importing goods from the United States and Europe, and investing billions of petrodollars in U.S. banks. During the 1960s and 70s, the United States supplied Iran with an arsenal of sophisticated weapons. In what must seem a cruel irony to a later generation, the United States even urged Iran to begin a large-scale nuclear power program to save its abundant oil reserves. U.S. leaders' open embrace of the repressive Shah, so soon after the CIA had overthrown an extremely popular Iranian leader, enraged most Iranians. One leading opponent of the Shah and his modernization program, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, declared, "Let the American president know that in the eyes of the Iranian people, he is the most repulsive member of the human race today because of the injustice he has imposed on our Muslim nation." For this and other outbursts, the Shah's government exiled Khomeini from his homeland in 1964. Over the next 15 years, the Iranian cleric kept up a steady stream of invective against both the Shah and his U.S. backers from Iraq and Paris. Iranian discontent continued to grow, fueled by the 1970s economic slowdown. Despite the Shah's dismal human rights record, Carter had backed additional arms sales to Iran, which had already been receiving more than any other nation. Ties between Carter and the Shah, whom the New York Times described as a ruler as close to an absolute monarch as exists these days, seemed to be strengthening, provoking many to decry Carter's hypocrisy on human rights. The Iranian royal couple paid a visit to the Carters in November 1977, staying at the White House. During their discussions, Carter gave preliminary approval to the sale of 6 to 8 light water nuclear reactors to Iran. When combined with the 14 to 16 that the Shah was negotiating to buy from France and West Germany, Iran would have a substantial nuclear power program. Hoping to show support for their beleaguered ally, President and Mrs. Carter shared an ornate and lavish New Year's Eve with the Shah in Tehran, as protesters demonstrated in both nations' capitals. 5 crystal wine glasses adorned the place setting of each of the 400 guests. Carter was effusive in his praise for his host. "Our talks have been priceless. Our friendship is irreplaceable. And my own gratitude is to the Shah, who, in his wisdom and with his experience, has been so helpful to me, a new leader. There is no leader with whom I have a deeper sense of personal gratitude and personal friendship." In subsequent months, huge protests renewed across Iran. In September, the Shah imposed martial law. Brzezinski urged Carter to either aggressively support the Shah or support a military coup. Fearing that the Soviets would seize the opportunity to move into the Gulf, he asked the Pentagon to draw plans for the United States to occupy Iran's oil fields. In December, he warned Carter that the United States faced the most massive American defeat since the beginning of the Cold War, overshadowing in its real consequences the setback in Vietnam. Brzezinski maneuvered behind the scenes to see if a coup was possible. Ambassador William Sullivan recalled, "I received a telephone call relaying a message from Brzezinski, who asked whether I thought I could arrange a military coup against the revolution. I regret the reply I made is unprintable." In January 1979, the Shah fled his country. Brzezinski feared a communist takeover. In what turned out to be a colossal failure of intelligence, the CIA and State Department downplayed the threat posed by Islamic fundamentalism. Henry Precht, the State Department's Iran desk officer, recounted how he had figured out what was brewing. "Late in November 1978, we called in all the experts on Iran to discuss what to do about Iran and what was going to happen there. The night before, I had guest lectured at a class at American University, and there were a lot of Iranian students there. When I asked what they thought was going to happen in Iran, they all said, 'Islamic government.' The next day at our conference, we went around the room all saying what we thought would happen, and people were saying things like, 'There will be a liberal government with a national front, and Khomeini will go to Qom.' When my turn came, I said, 'Islamic government.' I was the only one." In February, 77-year-old Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Tehran to a hero's welcome and set about establishing an Islamic republic based on Sharia law. The goal was to create a new caliphate. The head of the Iran branch at Langley assured the CIA's Tehran station, "Don't worry about another embassy attack. The only thing that could trigger an attack would be if the Shah was led into the United States. And no one in this town is stupid enough to do that." No one, that is, except for Carter, who buckled under pressure from Kissinger, David Rockefeller, Brzezinski, and other friends of the Shah. The Iranian public erupted in anger. In November, students burst into the embassy and seized 52 American hostages, whom they held for 444 days. Fearing Soviet intervention to quell the rising tide of Islamic fundamentalism, Carter rushed 25 warships to the Persian Gulf, including 3 nuclear-armed aircraft carriers and 1,800 Marines. He also blocked the release of Iranian assets in the United States and cut off oil imports from Iran. When those measures didn't lead to the hostages' release, the American public grew restive. Chief of Staff Hamilton Jordan alerted Carter to the fact that The American people are frustrated at our country's inability to do anything to free the prisoners and retaliate in a fashion that makes us feel better about ourselves. But Carter continued to show restraint. Khomeini's mistrust of the Soviet Union and its left-wing Iranian allies limited the extent to which the Soviets could exploit the situation. Khomeini's anti-Soviet feelings deepened when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in December 1979, and hardened further after Soviet-allied Iraq invaded Iran in September 1980. The Americans were lucky in one regard in terms of Iran. As part of Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program, the United States had sold dozens of research reactors to countries all over the world, including Iran, and had been supplying highly enriched uranium to fuel them. Some of the reactors used fuel enriched to 93%. Shortly before the Shah's ouster, the United States had sold Iran 58 pounds of weapons-grade uranium. Fortunately, the fuel had not yet been delivered when the revolutionary government seized power, and the sale was suspended. Crises seemed to be flaring all over. Central America, after suffering decades of poverty under U.S.-backed right-wing dictators, was ready to explode by the late 1970s. In Nicaragua, the Sandinista National Liberation Front, named after martyred guerrilla leader Augusto Sandino, threatened to overthrow President Anastasio Somoza Debayle. The Somoza family's brutal and corrupt 43-year rule had united the impoverished citizens in opposition. Carter administration officials feared that a Sandinista victory would embolden revolutionary forces in neighboring countries, especially Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Brzezinski argued for military intervention, citing the humiliation of appearing incapable of dealing with problems in our own backyard. While Carter weighed his options, the Sandinistas seized power in July 1979, Latin America's first successful revolution since Cuba's 20 years earlier, and began an ambitious program of land, education, and health reform. They put out feelers for better relations with the United States, and Congress responded by appropriating $75 million in emergency aid to the new government. But as reports surfaced that Nicaragua was transferring arms from Cuba into El Salvador, Carter halted aid 12 days before Reagan took office in January 1981. Carter also faced a moment of reckoning in El Salvador, where a small group of wealthy landowners, the 40 families, had ruled for over a century, using any means at their disposal to subdue the impoverished masses. Death squad murders increased in the 1970s to quell growing popular resistance. Following the 1980 assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, the various insurgent groups had coalesced to form the Frente Farabundo Martí para la Liberación Nacional, FMLN. By late 1980, with the FMLN insurgents poised to triumph, Carter, pressured by Brzezinski, opted to restore military aid to the dictatorship. A storm was also gathering in Afghanistan, a backward nation with a per capita annual income of only $70 in 1974. In 1976, the State Department reported that the United States is not, nor should it become, committed to or responsible for the protection of Afghanistan in any respect. But things changed when pro-Soviet rebels led by Nur Muhammad Taraki and Hafizullah Amin seized power in April 1978. Taraki, the new head of state, proclaimed, "The future for the people looks very bright." New York Times reporter William Borders took issue with that assessment. By the standards of almost any place else in the world, however, the future really does not look all that bright. Not in a land where the life expectancy is 40 years, where infant mortality is 18%, and no more than one person in 10 can read. Borders continued. Afghanistan has very few highways and not 1 mile of railway, and most of its people live either as nomads or as impoverished farmers in brown mud villages behind high walls, a life scarcely different from what it was when Alexander the Great passed this way 2,000 years ago. The Soviet Union, which had friendly relations with the previous government, actually opposed the coup, despite the prior government's repressive behavior toward Afghan communists. The new government's reform policies, particularly educational programs for women, land reform, and plans for industrialization, and harshly repressive tactics animated the growing insurgency by Afghan mujahideen, Islamist holy warriors operating out of Pakistan. A civil war was soon raging. The United States cast its lot with the mujahideen. Carter, uncomfortable with the religious zealotry and reactionary views of the insurgents, initially rejected Brzezinski's plans for covert operations against the new government. Brzezinski instead worked with the CIA to train and secure outside funding for the rebels. In February, Islamic extremists in Kabul kidnapped U.S. Ambassador Adolf Spike Dubs, who was killed when Afghan police and Soviet advisors stormed the hotel in which he was being held. The United States subsequently deepened its involvement in the country. Brzezinski saw more opportunity than danger in the growing Islamic fundamentalism. For several years, the United States had been working with Iranian and Pakistani intelligence to develop a right-wing Islamic fundamentalist movement within Pakistan that would later challenge governments sympathetic to the Soviet Union. Brzezinski later acknowledged that the United States had been supporting the Mujahideen even before the Soviet invasion. It was July 3, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. And that very day I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. Brzezinski understood the Soviets' fear that the Afghan insurgency would spark an uprising by the 40 million Muslims in Soviet Central Asia. Afghan leaders had been pressing Moscow to send troops to quell the uprising, and the Russians rebuffed their requests. Brezhnev instead urged them to ease repression of political opponents. Soviet leaders concluded correctly that the Americans were instigating the insurgency in cooperation with extremist elements in Iran and Pakistan. They figured that China might also be playing a role, but they still hesitated to intervene. Gromyko summed up their concerns. "We would be largely throwing away everything we achieved with such difficulty, particularly détente. The SALT II negotiations would fly by the wayside. There would be no signing of an agreement, and however you look at it, that is for us the greatest political priority. There would be no meeting of Brezhnev with Carter, and our relations with Western countries, particularly the FRG, would be spoiled." The Soviets opted to oust Amin, the driving force behind the repression, and replace him with Taraki. But the plan backfired, leaving Taraki dead and Amin more firmly entrenched in power. Not only did Amin then widen the repression, he also reached out to the United States for help. Dreading the thought of a pro-American regime on their southern border, replete with U.S. troops and Pershing II missiles, Soviet leaders decided to replace Amin with Babrak Karmal, despite knowing that the resulting instability might require them to send troops into the country. Military leaders opposed intervention, fearing that it would incite a unified Muslim response that would bog them down for years in a place they had no business being in. But Brezhnev foolishly insisted the war would be over in 3 to 4 weeks. His decision to send troops was made easier by the fact that détente with the West had already begun to unravel with growing U.S. opposition to ratifying SALT II, and NATO's decision to deploy new intermediate-range ballistic missiles in Europe. Still, as historian Melvin Leffler reminded readers, when they made their decision to intervene in Afghanistan, Soviet leaders saw threat, not opportunity. Defying his wary military advisors, Brezhnev deployed over 100,000 Soviet troops on Christmas Day, 1979. Up to the very eve of the invasion, the CIA kept assuring Carter that no such action was forthcoming. The world scoffed at the Soviet claim that it was defending against covert U.S. efforts to destabilize a government friendly to Moscow on the Soviet Union's border. Brzezinski cheered the invasion, believing he had lured Moscow into its own Vietnam trap. In full Cold War mode by that point, Carter called the invasion of Afghanistan the greatest threat to peace since the Second World War, a statement so hyperbolic that New York Times columnist Russell Baker felt compelled to remind him of the Berlin blockade, the Korean War, the Suez Crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the war in Vietnam. In his January 23, 1980 State of the Union address, Carter declared, "The region which is now threatened by Soviet troops in Afghanistan is of great strategic importance. It contains more than two-thirds of the world's exportable oil. The Soviet effort to dominate Afghanistan has brought Soviet military forces to within 300 miles of the Indian Ocean and close to the Straits of Hormuz, a waterway through which most of the world's oil must flow. The Soviet Union is now attempting to consolidate a strategic position, therefore, that poses a great threat to the free movement of Middle East oil. Let our position be absolutely clear. An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." The final sentence, which became enshrined as the Carter Doctrine, was interpreted in the Kremlin as a clear threat of war, even nuclear war. Vance attempted to remove it from the address, striking it from the draft that the State Department submitted to the White House. Brzezinski fought to keep it in, convincing Press Secretary Jody Powell that without it, the speech was devoid of content. Powell persuaded Carter that his national security advisor was right. Interviewed the following month on NBC News, Assistant Secretary of State William Dyess reiterated the threat, pointing out that the Soviets know that this terrible weapon has been dropped on human beings twice in history, and it was an American president who dropped it both times. The Soviets thought that U.S. accusations of Soviet aggression in the Middle East were preposterous, yet Carter withdrew the U.S. ambassador from Moscow and took SALT II off the table. He cut trade between the two countries, banned U.S. athletes from participating in the upcoming Moscow Olympics, increased defense spending, and sent Secretary of Defense Harold Brown to China to sound out Chinese leaders about establishing military ties. As many of Brezhnev's advisors had warned, the Soviet intervention did spark a much larger uprising on the part of Islamists, both inside and outside Afghanistan. Resistance groups based in Peshawar, Pakistan, joined with madrasa-trained Islamic zealots from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Pakistan to aid the Afghan resistance fighters. In Islamabad, 35 Muslim nations condemned the Soviet aggression. Brzezinski began looking for ways to fan the flames of potential discontent among Muslims in Soviet Central Asia. In earlier decades, the United States had employed Islamic fundamentalism as a weapon in the fight against secular Arab nationalism. It would now use Islamic extremism against the Soviet Union. But that meant cooperating with Pakistan's president, General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq. Carter had cut off aid to his repressive government in 1977 because of Zia's contempt for human rights and his nuclear weapons program. Now, within days of the invasion, Carter offered Zia hundreds of millions of dollars worth of military and economic aid in return for supporting the Islamist insurgents. In February 1980, Brzezinski traveled to Pakistan and Saudi Arabia to work out financial and military collaboration. Saudi Prince Turki Al-Faisal told a CIA officer, "We don't do operations. We don't know how. All we know how to do is write checks." The Saudis agreed to match the U.S. contributions. Despite Carter's saber-rattling, the United States would not have been able to repel a Soviet invasion of the Gulf, short of beginning a nuclear war. Carter therefore took measures to rectify that situation. He built up a rapid deployment force with new bases in Somalia, Kenya, and Oman, from which several thousand U.S. troops could be quickly deployed to the Gulf in a crisis. He strengthened ties with friendly governments in the region, such as Saudi Arabia. And he made a major adjustment in nuclear strategy, issuing Presidential Directive 59, which changed the U.S. nuclear war fighting strategy from fighting wars of mutually assured destruction to fighting flexible and limited nuclear wars that the United States could win. Not only did Carter's effort to eliminate nuclear weapons fall flat, PD-59 initiated a massive increase in conventional and nuclear arms. Under it, the United States prepared to fight a protracted nuclear war, first targeting Soviet leaders while holding attacks on cities in abeyance. Thus were dashed, once and for all, the hopes that Carter embodied for a safer and more peaceful world. During his one term in office, he managed to support research on the neutron bomb, authorized deployment of nuclear-armed cruise missiles to Europe, commissioned the first Trident submarine, and doubled the number of warheads aimed at the Soviet Union. Thus, despite having Carter in the White House, the CPD's campaign to defeat SALT II and increase defense spending had succeeded beyond its wildest dreams. In fact, by the end of his term, Carter had done a complete about-face and bought the CPD's view of an aggressive Soviet Union that had to be contained. Détente was dead. Carter even repudiated his earlier criticism of the Vietnam War. Vietnam veterans had long since become freedom fighters who went to Vietnam without any desire to capture territory or to impose American will on other people. Despite his best intentions, he had laid the groundwork for the extreme views that Reagan would bring to the White House. As Anne Kahn summarized in her book, Killing Détente, by the 1980 presidential election, the choice in foreign and defense policy was between that of the Carter administration, which favored the MX missile, the Trident submarine, a rapid deployment force, a stealth bomber, cruise missiles, counterforce targeting leading to a first strike capability, and a 5% increase in defense spending, and that of the Republicans under Ronald Reagan, who favored all of these, plus the neutron bomb, anti-ballistic missiles, the B-1 bomber, civil defense, and an 8% increase in defense spending. Not only did Carter not fulfill his promise to sharply reduce defense spending, he significantly increased it, from $115.2 billion in his first budget to $180 billion in his final one. Nor was he apologetic about this reversal. During his re-election campaign, he even got into a proxy war with the Republicans over the issue. Appearing on the Today Show in early July, Defense Secretary Harold Brown attacked the Republicans for cutting defense spending by more than 35% between 1969 and 1976, whereas the Carter administration had raised it by 10% during its time in office and planned to raise it an additional 25% during its second term. Former Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird challenged Brown's math, but admitted that defense spending had gone up faster under Carter than under Nixon or Ford. From the Soviet vantage point, U.S. behavior was quite alarming. As future CIA Director Robert Gates later admitted, the Soviets saw a very different Jimmy Carter than did most Americans by 1980. Different and more hostile and threatening. At that point, Soviet leaders didn't know what to expect from Carter. In late 1979 and early 1980, the U.S. early warning system malfunctioned on four occasions, triggering combat alerts of U.S. strategic forces. The KGB believed that they were not malfunctions, but deliberate Pentagon ploys to lower Soviet anxiety and response time during future alerts, by lulling them into a false sense of complacency, thereby making them vulnerable to a surprise attack. The Soviets weren't the only ones frightened by the episodes. Gates reported Brzezinski's account to him of the November 9, 1979 incident in his memoirs. Brzezinski was awakened at 3 a.m. by his military assistant, William Odom, who told him that some 220 Soviet missiles had been launched against the United States. Brzezinski knew that the president's decision time to order retaliation was from 3 to 7 minutes after a Soviet launch. Thus, he told Odom he would stand by for a further call to confirm a Soviet launch and the intended targets before calling the president. Brzezinski was convinced we had to hit back, and told Odom to confirm that the Strategic Air Command was launching its planes. When Odom called back, he reported that he had further confirmation, but that 2,200 missiles had been launched. It was an all-out attack. 1 minute before Brzezinski intended to telephone the president, Odom called a third time to say that other warning systems were not reporting Soviet launches. Sitting alone in the middle of the night, Brzezinski had not awakened his wife, reckoning that everyone would be dead in half an hour. It had been a false alarm. Someone had mistakenly put military exercise tapes into the computer system. When it was over, Zbigniew just went back to bed. I doubt he slept much, though. The dangerous incident, which was leaked to the press, caused alarm in the Kremlin. Ambassador Dobrynin conveyed Brezhnev's extreme anxiety over what happened. Brzezinski and the Defense Department drafted the response, which senior State Department advisor Marshall Shulman characterized as gratuitously insulting and inappropriate for the Carter-Brezhnev channel. Shulman considered it kindergarten stuff, not worthy of the United States, and wondered, why do we have to be so gratuitously snotty? Beset by a struggling economy and a series of poorly handled foreign policy crises, Carter appeared weak and out of touch as the 1980 election approached. Perhaps the final nail in his coffin came in April 1980, when the United States completely bungled a hostage rescue attempt, leaving 8 Americans dead in the Iranian desert after a helicopter collided with a refueling plane. The Iranian government triumphantly displayed the charred bodies, adding to the humiliation. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, who had consistently opposed this harebrained scheme, resigned in protest, something no Secretary of State had done since William Jennings Bryan. He wrote his letter of resignation 4 days before the ill-fated raid. Columnist Mary McGrory noted that Vance had served in the Johnson administration during another war he had come to oppose, and knew full well that his resignation would be divisive at a critical time. In fact, she wrote, he apparently intends it to be. He found out a long time ago that keeping your mouth shut during discussions of madness is often the greatest disservice you can do your country. Carter's approval rating plummeted to 40%. Although widely recognized as the most respected member of the administration, Vance had been increasingly marginalized for quite some time, as Brzezinski's hawkish views drowned out Vance's efforts at diplomacy. Vance's influence had steadily waned, and by the late 1970s, virtually disappeared. The Washington Post observed, Mr. Vance had fallen out of phase with the president. The secretary and the early Carter spoke for a benevolent and rationalistic world in which the United States, by accommodating certain legitimate imperatives of others, would find its proper place. The world to which Mr. Carter, much more than Mr. Vance, has sought to adjust recently is one in which factors of power and perversity loom large. As the Wall Street Journal noted, the motivating force behind Vance's decision was the increasingly hawkish tone in the administration's foreign policy, beginning in 1978 with the president buying the case put by Brzezinski. Vance weighed in a few days later, telling an interviewer that the National Security Advisor should act as the coordinator of different views, but he should not be the one who makes foreign policy or who expresses foreign policy to the public. Carter himself entered the fray a few days later. In what seemed a very petty reaction, he told a Philadelphia town meeting that his new Secretary of State, Edmund Muskie, would be a much stronger and more statesmanlike senior citizen figure, who would be a more evocative spokesman for our nation's policy than Vance had been. For Carter, who had been holed up in the White House throughout the Iran hostage crisis, a symbolic hostage of his own making, it was the first major public address outside Washington in over 6 months. Following the Iranian Revolution, U.S. officials cozied up to Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, whom they saw as a regional counterweight to the hostile Iranian regime. They feared that the Iranian-style Islamic fundamentalism could threaten pro-American regimes in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. Brzezinski strategized ways to sever Iraq from the Soviet orbit. In September 1980, Saddam, with at least tacit U.S. approval, invaded neighboring Iran, attacking across the Shatt al-Arab waterway, leading to the Persian Gulf. Iraq, however, did not secure the easy victory that U.S. intelligence sources had predicted. Within a week, the United Nations called for a ceasefire. In late October, Carter, playing both sides, announced that if the Iranians released the U.S. hostages, the United States would send the $300 million to $500 million in arms that had been purchased by the prior regime. Reaganites smelled an October surprise that would hand Carter the election. In what Carter White House Iran aide and Columbia University political scientist Gary Sick called a political coup, a group of Reagan supporters were alleged to have cut a deal with the Iranian government. At the time, the presidential race was still tight. Some mid-October polls even had Carter in the lead. The details are murky and impossible to confirm, but it appears that Reagan campaign officials met with Iranian leaders and promised to allow Israel to ship arms to Iran if Iran would hold the hostages until Reagan won the election. In response to a 1992 query from Indiana Congressman Lee Hamilton, the Supreme Soviet's Committee on Defense and Security Issues reported that a series of secret meetings had taken place in Europe between top Reagan campaign officials and Iranian officials. The Soviet report identified Reagan campaign manager and future CIA director William Casey, vice presidential candidate and former CIA director George Bush, and NSC staffer and future CIA director Robert Gates as attending and offering substantially more military supplies than the Carter team was offering. Iran released the embassy personnel on January 21, 1981. Reagan's first day in office. The United States continued arms sales to Iran via Israel, often channeled through private dealers, for several years. An early chance to end the war, which Saddam offered to do in return for Iraqi control of the Shatt al-Arab waterway, and an Iranian promise not to interfere in Iraq, was also squandered. With the United States helping fuel the conflict, the Iran-Iraq War would continue for 8 years, leaving, some estimate, over 1 million dead and costing over $1 trillion. Chapter 11. The Reagan Years. Death Squads for Democracy. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan threw down the gauntlet in Berlin. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And on November 9, 1989, less than 2.5 years after Ronald Reagan spoke those stirring words, the wall came down. The Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe soon crumbled. In 1991, the Soviet Union itself collapsed. The Cold War was over. Many credit Reagan with winning the Cold War, and some lionize him as one of the United States' great presidents. But was Reagan really the heroic champion of freedom and democracy who brought closure to the most dangerous era in human history? Or was there a darker side to the man and his administration that made a mockery of his words? What really lay behind the smiling facade of this most unlikely of presidents? Ronald Reagan, the folksy, homespun actor turned General Electric pitchman, had been California governor since 1967. He espoused strong family values, but was estranged from his children and was the first president to divorce. A man of limited knowledge but deep religious beliefs and strong conservative convictions, he provided little guidance on policy and had no interest in or grasp of detail. His vice president, George H.W. Bush, confessed to Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin that he at first found Reagan's views on international relations almost unimaginable. Bush, Dobrynin wrote, was simply amazed to see to what extent Reagan was dominated by Hollywood clichés and the ideas of his wealthy but conservative and poorly educated friends from California. National Security Council Soviet expert Richard Pipes admitted that at NSC meetings, the president seemed really lost, out of his depth, uncomfortable. Very early in the new administration, counterterrorism coordinator Anthony Quainton was summoned to brief the president. In Quainton's words, "I gave that briefing to the president, who was joined by the vice president, the head of CIA, the head of the FBI, and a number of National Security Council members. After a couple of jelly beans, the president dozed off. That was quite unnerving." Jimmy Carter was deeply troubled by Reagan's complete lack of curiosity when he tried to brief the incoming president on the challenges he would face, assessments of world leaders, and command and control of nuclear weapons. Carter aide Jody Powell recounted, "The boss really thought it was important for Reagan to know this stuff before he was sworn in, and as he ran through it, he couldn't believe that Reagan wasn't asking any questions. He thought maybe Reagan wasn't taking any notes because he didn't have a pad and pencil, and finally offered him one. But Reagan said, no thanks, he could remember it. It was just the damnedest thing." Many of Reagan's close associates were struck by the depth of his ignorance. Upon returning from his late 1982 Latin American tour, Reagan told reporters, "Well, I learned a lot. You'd be surprised. They're all individual countries." Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau wondered, what planet is that man living on? When the president told him that the Soviets had brought an American priest to Moscow in order to send him back to be a spokesman for Actors Equity. Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill was startled when Reagan, admiring O'Neill's desk that had belonged to Grover Cleveland, told him that he had played Cleveland in the movie, The Winning Season. O'Neill reminded him that the desk had belonged to President Cleveland, not Grover Cleveland Alexander the pitcher. O'Neill, who served in the House for 34 years, said that Reagan knows less than any president I've ever known. Reagan's simplistic worldview seemed to be a pastiche stitched together from Hallmark greeting cards, Currier and Ives lithographs, Benjamin Franklin aphorisms, Hollywood epics, and Chinese fortune cookies. He wrote, "I'd always felt that from our deeds, it must be clear to anyone that Americans were a moral people, who had always used our power only as a force for good in the world." He often displayed a striking inability to differentiate between reality and fantasy. In a late 1983 Oval Office meeting, he told Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir that as a photographer during the Second World War, he had filmed the Allies liberating the Nazi death camps and had been so moved by the suffering he witnessed that he had decided to keep a copy of the film in case he ever encountered a Holocaust skeptic. Shamir was so impressed with Reagan's story that he repeated it to his cabinet, and it was printed in the Israeli paper Ma'ariv. Reagan later repeated a variant of the story to Simon Wiesenthal and Rabbi Marvin Heyer, telling them that he had been with the Signal Corps filming the camps and had shown the film to someone just a year after the war. Hearing the story, Washington Post reporter Lou Cannon noted that Reagan had never left the United States during or immediately after the war. The story was entirely fanciful. Reporters then had a field day revealing other Reagan whoppers. Chicago Tribune columnist Mike Royko, perhaps to dispel the notion that the president's flights of fancy were a product of old age or related to his diminishing mental powers, wrote that he first became aware of Reagan's habit of altering the truth in 1968, when, to highlight how lawless society was becoming, Reagan asserted that 8 Chicago police officers had been killed in one recent month alone. Royko, curious, discovered that no cops had been killed in Chicago in months, and only 1 or 2 in the entire year. Reagan often repeated his story about the Chicago welfare queen, with 80 names, 30 addresses, and 12 Social Security cards, who had a tax-free income of over $150,000. The numbers would change. She sometimes had 127 names and received over 100 different checks. But the point, an attack on greedy, dishonest blacks who stole from hard-working white Americans, remained the same. Compiling lists of Reaganisms became a national pastime. Reagan often made up apocryphal quotes from prominent individuals, including Oliver Wendell Holmes and Winston Churchill. Perhaps it was fitting, therefore, that his press spokesman, Larry Speaks, admitted that he had made up quotes and attributed them to Reagan, anticipating what he would have wanted to say. For meetings with visitors and even with his own cabinet officials, Reagan read from 3x5-inch file cards provided by staffers. Visitors would be mortified on those occasions when he unknowingly read from the wrong set of cards. He extrapolated from personal experience to form his views of the world. Facts could be ignored or contradicted when they didn't support his preferred narrative. When William Clark, a former California Supreme Court justice, took over as National Security Advisor in 1982, he was shocked to discover how little Reagan actually knew about the world. He instructed the Pentagon and CIA to produce films explaining security issues and describing the world leaders Reagan would be meeting. Reagan's disengaged style and lack of foreign policy experience left the door open to palace intrigue among his subordinates, who were eager to fill the void. Vice President Bush displayed firm, if nefarious, establishment credentials, with long-standing family ties to Rockefeller, Morgan, and Harriman interests. After graduating from Yale, he had moved to Texas, become an oil man, and run unsuccessfully for the Senate in 1970. Richard Nixon had engineered his appointment as Republican Party chairman. Jean Kirkpatrick would also play a prominent role in shaping foreign policy. A conservative Democrat and Georgetown political scientist who supported Reagan because of his staunch anti-communism, she was rewarded with an appointment as ambassador to the United Nations. Kirkpatrick supplied the Reaganites with a justification for supporting right-wing dictatorships, calling them authoritarian regimes instead of totalitarian ones. Along with her colleague Ernest Lefevre, who directed Georgetown's Ethics and Public Policy Center, she contemptuously dismissed Jimmy Carter's concern for human rights and reform programs. Lefevre, a defender of repressive regimes from El Salvador to South Africa, became Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. The New York Times described him as an ultra-conservative who sneers at existing policy as sentimental nonsense and believes it is profound error to embarrass allies, however repressive, with talk about habeas corpus. He dismissed concerns about torture in Argentina and Chile because it was a residual practice of the Iberian tradition. His center had recently been assailed for accepting a large contribution from Nestle after conducting a study supportive of its campaign to convince mothers to replace breastfeeding with infant formula, despite evidence that the switch had contributed to a tripling of infant malnutrition in underdeveloped nations. In June, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee rejected Lefevre as unqualified for the position. 5 of the committee's 9 Republicans joined with all 8 Democrats in the vote. He was replaced by the equally objectionable Elliot Abrams. Not everyone welcomed the opportunity for freelancing that resulted from Reagan's inattention. General Colin Powell, the deputy to National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci, recalled, "The president's passive management style placed a tremendous burden on us. Until we got used to it, we felt uneasy implementing recommendations without a clear decision." One morning, Frank moaned, "My God, we didn't sign on to run this country." James Baker, who served Reagan as campaign manager, White House chief of staff, and Treasury secretary, described the resulting foreign policy structure as a witch's brew of intrigue and separate agendas. Though often at one another's throats over control of policy, Reagan's top advisors shared an enthusiasm for covert operations. Together with Secretary of State Alexander Haig and Bush, they initiated operations in Central America and Africa through the National Security Planning Group, while supporting Soviet bloc dissidents and expanding Carter's programs in Afghanistan. Global economic travails made their job easier. The rapid economic growth experienced by resource-rich third-world countries in the 1960s and early 1970s, ground to a halt by the mid-1970s, as the worldwide economic decline undercut income earned through raw material exports. Third world debt ballooned, crippling the prospects for continued development and devastating already impoverished populations. Revolutionary states that had overthrown colonialist regimes and experimented with socialism were among the hardest hit, leading many to question the viability of leftist development models. Reagan saw the resulting unrest as an opportunity to topple unfriendly governments and prove the superiority of capitalism. The Soviet economy also hit the skids in the late 1970s, beginning a sustained period of stagnation and decline that only worsened when oil prices collapsed in 1982. Military expenditures, which absorbed almost a quarter of the gross domestic product, GDP, were further weakening the economy. Reagan was determined to exploit the situation. At his first press conference, on January 29, 1981, he unleashed an anti-communist diatribe that reversed almost two decades of progress in easing Cold War tensions. "Well, so far détente's been a one-way street that the Soviet Union has used to pursue its own aims, the promotion of world revolution and a one-world socialist or communist state, whichever word you want to use. They, at the same time, have openly and publicly declared that the only morality they recognize is what will further their cause, meaning they reserve unto themselves the right to commit any crime, to lie, to cheat, in order to attain that, and that is moral, not immoral, and we operate on a different set of standards." The CIA, which had largely been kept in check by Carter, played a major role in Reagan's new anti-communist crusade. CIA analysts had long prided themselves on professionalism and distance from the operations side of the agency. That would not fly with the Reagan team. The assault that began via Bush's Team B reached fruition under Casey. Administration hardliners wanted intelligence that supported their view of a dangerous, hostile, and expansion-minded Soviet Union, regardless of how far such a perception departed from reality. Casey, a multimillionaire Wall Street lawyer and devout Irish Catholic, had come to the CIA, according to his deputy Robert Gates, to wage war against the Soviet Union. According to Gates, the Reaganites saw their arrival as a hostile takeover. Casey had read Claire Sterling's The Terror Network and was convinced that the Soviet Union was the font of all international terrorism. According to Melvin Goodman, head of the CIA's Office for Soviet Analysis, "Several of us met with Casey to try to tell the director that much of Sterling's so-called evidence was in fact CIA black propaganda, anti-communist allegations planted in the European press." But, he added, Casey contemptuously noted that he learned more from Sterling than from all of them. Others who touted the Sterling line included Haig, Wolfowitz, State Department consultant Michael Ledeen, and State Department official Robert Bud McFarlane. CIA experts, however, knew that the Soviets, for all their faults, actually discouraged terrorism. Casey and Gates began a purge of analysts who refused to knuckle under. If their reports failed to support the administration line, Casey just wrote his own conclusions. Goodman, who served as a senior CIA Soviet analyst from 1966 to 1986, observed, "The CIA caricature of a Soviet military octopus whose tentacles reached the world over supported the administration's view of the evil empire." Goodman blamed the fact that the CIA missed the most important historical development in its history, the collapse of the Soviet empire and the Soviet Union itself, largely on the culture and process that Gates established in his directorate. While CIA intelligence was being dismantled, operations were running amok. Colonel John Wogelstein, who headed the U.S. military advisory team in El Salvador, stated, "Real counterinsurgency techniques are a step toward the primitive." That description could be applied to the efforts of U.S.-backed and trained government forces in El Salvador and Guatemala, and to the U.S.-run insurgency in Nicaragua. These freedom fighters, as Reagan called them, routinely raped, tortured, castrated, mutilated, decapitated, and dismembered their victims. To harden Guatemalan soldiers to the point where they were able to kill some 100,000 Mayan peasants between 1981 and 1983, army recruits were beaten, degraded, even submerged in sewage, and forced to remain covered in shit for extended periods of time. Broken and dehumanized, they carried out brutal acts. In December 1982, in the village of Dos Eres, the army slaughtered over 160 people, swinging the 65 child victims by their feet and smashing their heads against the rocks. Just the day before, Ronald Reagan had visited Guatemala as part of a tour of Latin America and complained that its president, General Efraín Ríos Montt, a born-again evangelical Christian who had recently seized power in a military coup, had received a bum rap, assuring reporters that the dictator was totally committed to democracy. Reagan called him a man of great personal integrity and commitment. In fact, he said that in light of Guatemala's improved human rights record, he was considering restoring military aid, which Carter had cut off in 1977 because of the government's deplorable human rights record. Reagan was apparently comfortable with Ríos Montt's explanation that, "We have no scorched earth policy."